Okay, so welcome everybody to day number 17 of the Inner Warriors Summit. What an honor it is to be interviewing all these inspiring spiritual teachers, shamans, thought leaders, and healers who are all such beacons of light, love, and hope, all reminding us of the importance of walking with our fears, shining light on our shadows, and doing our inner warrior work, and also of the importance of taking responsibility for how our ways of thinking, being, and consciously dreaming directly affect our own lives, the planet, and the entire web of life. My guest today is Terry Patton, who's a community organizer, philosopher, and wise teacher who's devoted his entire life and efforts to the integral project of evolving consciousness through practice and facing, examining, and healing our global crisis through the marriage of spirit and activism. I love that. Patton co-wrote Integral Life Practice, which distills ancient and modern practices into a contemporary transformational lifestyle, and is the creator and host of the online series Beyond Awakening, where he explores the big questions of our time with some of our most prominent and dynamic thought leaders and much more. Terry's also the author of his new book, A New Republic of the Heart, an Ethos for Revolutionaries, where he delves deeply into a new form of activism that fuses the inner work of personal transformation and awakening with the outer work of service and commitment to social justice, which we'll take a very good look at today. So welcome, Terry. I'm so excited to have you with me today.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here with you, Susan. It's an exciting and sometimes pretty terrifying time in finding our way to a healthy relationship to all of what inspires and provokes us at every level. It's a very human affair, and it deserves a deep conversation.
Yes, definitely. So, Terry, in your new book, which has just been published last week, I believe, A New Republic of the Heart, you call for a new form of activism that combines, as I said before, the inner work of spiritual development and the outer work of political engagement that you call this evolutionary activism. How did you come to believe that this is what our current challenges require?
Well, you know, for me, my personal history was that I was raised by activists. When I was six, my parents moved to the York Center Community Cooperative, a small community of a little less than 100 acres, about 20 miles west of the downtown area of Chicago. It had been founded by members of the Church of the Brethren, one of the peace churches in the United States, and they had decided they really admired the principles of cooperative ownership. And when they did this, it ended up being that some of the people that were also attracted to those principles were not just pacifists like the Brethren, but they were involved in interracial civil rights movement, which was such a big thing in those years. The community was founded in 1944, 45, 46. My family moved there in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up growing up with these co-op aunts and uncles who were Japanese families that had been interned during the war, a lot of people who'd spent the war doing conscientious objector, alternative service, or in prison, and some old lefties who were labor organizers and socialists, and even one unrepentant communist. And so I was mentored by people to feel that there was a spiritual or moral basis for taking a social stand. And since I grew up during the Vietnam War years, and I was the kid in my generation who was probably most interested in current events and politics, I ended up having quite an experience of being mentored, and had a very active life involved with Students for a Democratic Society, the Chicago area draft resistors, and I was a pretty all-in activist, very young. But then I realized that my own maturity just was not profound enough to be the basis for a reformulation of the politics, the public agreements, that the revolution, if there was to be one, really had to begin with my own heart and my own consciousness. And that led me to spending the next 15 years in an ashram. Mm. And that led me to noticing the profound potentials of spiritual growth, but also the necessity of a more and more integral approach that included, you know, almost all our traditions are in one way or another partial or exclusionary. And so eventually I found my way into working very closely with Ken Wilber and the Integral Institute and helping create an integration of the ancient spiritual paths with modern scientific insights, you know, a lot of them based on neuroscience. And so that I wrote the book Integral Life Practice about 10 years ago. But what's been going on in our world during these years is that we're discovering that our ecological predicament is far more dire than almost any of us have been able to fully face. The actual temperature readings and extreme weather incidents seem to be tracking a trajectory of global warming and global weirding of our weather patterns that is significantly worse than what was formerly thought to be the worst case scenario back when limits to growth and overshoot, the major texts of understanding how an economy that depends on constant growth can collide with the, you know, the finite limits of a living Earth that is of only a certain size. There were models, the famous computer models that Donella Meadows and the team that wrote Limits to Growth created back in the 70s. There were, you know, three trajectories: best case, probable case, worst case. Well, our actual readings are worse than the worst case. Mm-hmm. And this is why, you know, 350.org, you know, is talking about 350 parts per million, and we're at something like 410 parts per million and climbing. And the implications of that are that big chunks of the Earth are probably going to be desertified and become uninhabitable, and there will be sea level rises, and there will be mass migrations, and there will be financial losses too great for insurance or even governmental aid to meet with, and we have a society that isn't able to reckon with all that, and this creates a spiritual crisis, because it's so upsetting to face these realities and to find a way to face them that brings all of ourselves forward. Because if we're deeply drawing on the most profound spiritual wisdom, we realize that what is cannot be a problem. In fact, that even, you know, this moment, any moment, is a profound blessing, and that our right relationship to reality is not one of fear and angst and, you know, non-acceptance. It's one of gratitude and wonder and joy and trust in being. So how do we have the sanity of being involved in that kind of trust in being and being, and also have the honesty and courage to face an almost unthinkable civilizational predicament in which it probably will be that many, you know, the long term, that the Earth may not be able to support so many people, even if we have amazing technological breakthroughs. And that's the other side of the story, that there are going to be wonders that change these realities, probably, that there really will be wondrous transformations coincident with the difficult futures that the climate and environmental science predict. But coming into contact with all that is a spiritual task. And I wanted to write a book that faced that and spoke about that. And that's a heart-to-heart conversation that you and I can have right here, right now.
Yeah.
And that then draws us forward, because you can't be real with this and not and then just stand idly by and watch the destruction of our shared future. So it implies engagement, but that engagement is going to tend to be rooted in dilemma and anxiety, and it's going to be just a bummer. And you know, people who face this darkness, they go through these dark nights of the soul, can become so disheartened that they're almost radioactive. Nobody's attracted to you. You know, those of us who've dared to go through this dark night journey are sometimes just deranged by the process. So it takes profound spiritual practice to be with all of this in a sane and happy and magnetic way. And so that's the summary answer.
Yeah, and I heard you say, I love when I was reading what you were saying about, instead of following your bliss, you should follow your heartbreak and your genius with your friends when you're talking. And so I'm hearing you talk about that. There is something about, it's so painful to actually be in the reality, in the moment of what's happening right here, and there's also incredible possibility of deep spiritual awakening, as well as a deep inspiration at the same time, when we allow ourselves to be in a cracked open place, in that heartbreak place. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, we have lots and lots of built-in psychological defenses against this heartbreak, against feeling the reality of our collective situation. The society that we're in as a whole, even among scientists who are very aware of the reality of global warming and the climate emergency, most scientists think that a superintelligence gone wrong is a bigger threat to the human future than our ecological predicament. There's a very, very big barrier against letting ourselves feel our embeddedness in the living earth and in the other creatures and in our family of relations. And because it just takes us down, you know, the fact that we are living middle class lives in any reasonably prosperous contemporary society, we're part of the problem. If we live in the United States, we're probably driving cars. Many of us fly in planes. All of our lifestyle behaviors is the stuff we live in a consumer economy. Mm-hmm. And so we are the problem. As we awaken to the situation and want to be the change, we awaken even as we recognize, wow, I am being the very thing that is, you know, I'm like a maggot eating its host, you know, that horrified, there's a moral dilemma in facing that. And so that heartbreak is rarely really felt. These conversations are usually had in an abstracted, mentalized state where we don't deeply feel the full implications of the facts as we know them. And that, it tends to make us authentic, inauthentic rather. It removes something of the health and empowerment that we have from living in a right relationship to reality. And so the journey to just face and feel all that can be almost deranging. So I think that takes tremendous courage. And yet if we find our way into contact with that heartbreak in a healthy way, it doesn't take over everything. There's actually a joy on the other side of despair.
Exactly.
There's a hope of a different kind. And that becomes our possibility. So it takes a kind of, you know, hair-raising ordeal to pass from our complacent, denial-based, insulated, comfortable lives to ones that have this other kind of hope. But if we get to that place, then a whole different thing opens up. And, you know, the original statement, follow your bliss, came from Joseph Campbell, who was actually talking about something beautiful and true. I don't so much mean to debunk Campbell, but it can be taken trivially to be an injunction to just be self-involved. And our care for others and for our shared world, as we awaken to recognize that we're not separate, you know, that the well-being of the whole living earth is part of who I am. There can be an awakening to transcendental consciousness, to something that is, there's a kind of well-being that is unconditional and that will survive the destruction of human-friendly conditions on planet Earth, that could survive this sixth great extinction, extincting, you know, most mammals. You know, it could survive pretty much anything. And yet, too many people are relating to their spiritual lives as if the main point of their spirituality is to help them feel better, whereas this engaged spirituality that I was raised with has some really important virtues that create the basis for fellowship, for a brother sisterhood that is really where we lie, where we belong. Yeah, that's what I've called a new republic of the heart.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
And what I've found, Terry, is that in this cracking open, you know, really, really allowing ourselves to do that, if we really go deeply and courageously into that, it takes away all of our resistance and barriers to, you know, I know myself, you know, I can only go there and I can't really delve into that. But when we really, truly crack open, we're then open to the whole. There is no separateness anymore. I mean, that's part of the pain, is that we want to be able to be like, well, I can't really think about that. That's not really my problem. But when we really do that cracking open, we then become truly one with it all. And then there's that, as you talk about, that wholeness and that we space really opens up. And I feel like that's really that cutting edge, that evolutionary place of the heart, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a, you know, the curriculum, you might say, of life, this school that life is, that is teaching us endless lessons. And we get the same lessons again and again until we actually learn them, is sometimes teaching us lessons about freedom, about disidentifying, and sometimes it teaches us lessons about responsibility, about relationship, about essentially not doing a spiritual bypass and opting for an experience of freedom that disconnects us from the relative world where so much is at stake all the time, where life and death happen, where loss, sickness, old age, and death, the heavenly messengers, where everything, you know, injustice, where historical events take place. And this, you know, big theme of my book has to do with the moment that we're in right now in the United States, the Trump presidency, the ecological responsibility being abandoned by our government, for at least this administration. And a lot of these problems cannot really be effectively addressed except with policy and with wise collective decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, you know, yes, you may not enjoy calling your representative, you may not enjoy paying attention to the news, you may not like going to town meetings or any of the other apparent forms of political engagement. And yet, if we cede that territory to people who are consumed with identity politics and anger, that's a moral failure on our part. We actually can't escape into our spirituality. We have to find a way for our spiritual practice to make us effective participants in our civic life and to take responsibility for these collective decisions that are so, so consequential. What happens in your and my lifetime may have enormous effects on the future of many, many living creatures, maybe species, maybe the conditions that will pertain during the lifetimes of, you know, if we have descendants, our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, or those generations, even if we don't. There's nothing that could have more moral force than those kind of consequences. And yet, when we take those things seriously, we go so much into the imminent, conditional, you know, you might say the dilemma side of the equation. Everything seems so fraught with significance that it tends to make us incredibly uptight. And in that uptightness, we lose the awakened freedom with which we could take enlightened action. And so there's a real task in our own development. I sometimes like to use the phrase, awakening needs to get woke. You know, this term is used in Black Lives Matter movement, but it's used in other activists' conditions. You know, the woke community needs to get awakened too, by the way, that getting woke to the importance of what happens in time and space can also be reductive. One of the profundities of our time is that real wisdom has to include apparently contradictory truths in a profound dialogue with one another. And that ability to contain contradiction is something that only comes with time and wisdom. And so, you know, this is where a wise elder maybe can make a real difference, helping people to be with this reality in a way that doesn't oversimplify it and turn it into a slogan and turn it into an oversimplified game, all of which are inadequate to meet the profundity of our challenges.
Right, and I feel like it really takes, you know, a profound and different way of listening to everything. You know, I mean, I know that for myself. I've had this conversation with quite a few of the people on here. Sandra Ingerman and I were talking about it, and a number of other people, that place of holding it all, and how are we listening and not separating even from people who, the way they're being and their politics and whatever are just like so different from what we could even imagine accepting or being with. and it requires us to be able to hear in a way that is way beyond ourselves in that place of separation and right and wrong. That's like that space in between is a powerful place to be, and it does take a lot of courage and a lot of awareness and willingness, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, I think that, like, you're a teacher and an activist, a shaman. You know, you're involved in this,
mm-hmm.
and you're working your edges here. I think that each of us is a work in progress. We're more and more fully coming into our freedom, our wisdom, our benevolence, our ability to be of service. To some degree, we're doing the inner work and we're doing the outer work. And yet, there's always more. We could be more effective somehow. We could be freer somehow. We could be
mm-hmm.
more generous, more mature, more generative. And, you know, a fruitful part of the conversation we might be able to have here together now might be to talk about the growing edges of our practice, of how you're doing your inner work and your outer work, and yet how maybe more is possible, and where you're noticing opportunities to grow. And I'm certainly willing to share about that too. Does that feel like an interesting direction to go in?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you. I was just going to open up the conversation of that. I was reading that you're saying, you know, our society is so used to this. The hero is thought of as an exceptional individual who saves the kingdom, but then you're talking about, I believe you're talking about this in your book too, about rethinking that and to embrace a more feminine version of that. And so for me, as a woman who's willing to be courageous and do my inner work, for me, doing my inner work, which is really, really being honest and just really clear about, you know, not being perfect. And, of course, we all have our things. But to me, it's about really, really deepening into that deep feminine wisdom rooted in the earth and flowing through us in a way that's really connecting with her dreaming. And for me, that's really following intuition. It's really following spirit in such a deep way that it's way beyond thought. And also it's about being responsible in every moment as much as I possibly can to be very aware of the energies that I am emitting every moment in my thoughts, as I was saying earlier, in my thoughts, in my emotions, in my interactions with others. You know, it is not going to help anybody or anything if I'm holding a space of judgment or if I'm holding a space of being right or even hatred that can come up and rage that can come up, certainly in terms of some of the political situations that are going on. And I'll say out loud, our presidency, that has been an incredible challenge. And I just know, and I am constantly being guided by my guides to really be, that this is a time for us to even more hold our light and even more be aware of not being lured into those darker, more dense forces or energies, and to continue to emanate out love, emanate out light all the time. And so for me, that is primarily what I'm practicing all the time. And it's very challenging in these times, as we were talking about. It's to be in that space of being cracked wide open and really feeling into where we are as a collective, as a planet, is heartbreaking. And it is also... it's also incredibly exciting on some level as well. And so I'm always at that edge of holding. I hold a place of not being in denial, and also holding a place of hope and light, just really being in that light and love, being a very healing elixir for the collective, for the planet, for the web of life. So that's a little bit of how I hold all of this myself in my practice.
That's beautiful, beautiful and profound. I love hearing your, you know, I can feel you in your whole description. You didn't mention anything directly about how you're engaged in trying to create political change specifically. How are you relating to that side of the outer work?
Well, I sign petitions all the time. You know, I'm constantly contributing money to causes that I feel are really, you know, I swear every day something will come through, and I just immediately contribute in that way. And also for me, I'm not out beating the streets necessarily. I mean, I live in the middle of the woods, but my way is also to encourage myself and others to be active in their communities. And that's really starting with family. That's starting them in communities, being willing to stand there in the supermarket. I remember after the election, standing in the supermarket, and I was just like, I had the most, and in the airport, I kept having these profound meetings. I mean, I'm sitting next to a U.S. general. I'm sitting next to somebody who used to work at West Point. It was like I kept having these ending up in conversations with people who were way on the other side of everything. And it was an amazing experience because I was absolutely committed, totally committed to being in my heart and listening from that place. You know, I'm like, why is it that you trust this person that I have no trust in whatsoever? And then being in the space of listening to another human being, listening from that place. So that's kind of activism in a really, like, one-on-one way for me. You know, when I'm out in the world, as at airports or wherever I am, the supermarket, you know, with my main community in line, buying whatever, I will have those conversations, and I seek out people who are on, quote, the other side of this political discussion. And really, I really am very interested in hearing how it is that they, especially women, how is it that you could possibly, I don't understand how you could possibly trust somebody like this, or people who are, you know, and it's like that conversation I find really fascinating. So I hope that kind of answers your question. I'm in action and in activism wherever I possibly can be, and encouraging the people that I'm working with, my clients and all of that, to be in that space themselves, to really see when they want to go into right and wrong, where they want to go into creating polarity, and really hold and just really deepening into a heart space and into their wombs and connecting to the earth, and bravely and courageously opening up and being in their heart in the crucible of it all, call it. And I feel like that's really powerful and very effective, more effective for me than getting on a bus and going in a march right now. For me, that feels more effective and deeper, just in terms of how I can relate to the world and emanate out. I'm literally sending energy across the world and holding space and seeing those oceans as beautiful and purified, and not and holding space with the ocean and the earth and the mountains and all of that in a space of light and radiating healing in that direction. Does that answer your question?
You know, I'm very resonant with that, and that's a big part of what I do too. I also think that it's important that we read. One of the things I do in my book is that I point out that there are a lot of different kinds of activism. There's in-the-system activism, which is some of the stuff that you do. You vote, right? You don't fail to participate. Yeah, that's a moral responsibility. So that's what, you know, and if you're sending emails to congresspeople and signing petitions, that's also in the system activism, you know, and there can be a lot more. You can call your congressperson or, you know, there's a variety of things. And then there's against the system activism, which is more like marching and protesting and, you know, but that's a very valid thing. All those folks who rushed to the airports when the Muslim ban was introduced, how many Islamic people saw that and appreciating that were less likely to be radicalized by the racism against Muslims that was also, you know, being articulated by the Muslim ban. So that was, you know, there's a real validity to that, but it isn't like everybody has to do it. You know, it's not like every person in the country had to go to the airport that day. We have to find a way to really appreciate that kind of activism and yet not turn it into a test of purity that everybody has to do it. On the other hand, in a time in which, you know, many people are afraid that we're going into a kind of a new kind of fascism, there's a fair amount of involvement that a lot of people need to have, and I think it's good that we challenge ourselves to see if there's ways we can be more effective. But then there's another kind of activism that isn't in the system or against the system. It goes around the system. That's something I talk about in my book. And, you know, if you educate girls in the third world, you change the world, but you're not really seemingly involved in what we would traditionally call activism. Or if you have a new technology that would make fossil fuels uncompetitive in certain applications, that'll change the world too, but it wouldn't necessarily look like activism on the surface. Or if you just change your diet, don't eat as many killed foods, or, you know, don't contribute to the factory farming industry.
Yeah.
You know, that's a form of activism. So understanding activism more broadly and appreciating that everybody has a unique involvement, but not using that as an excuse to get ourselves off the hook. Like if we're alive in this time when so much matters, somehow we have to stay in a, like it's like a koan, you know, a Japanese Zen riddle. It's like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? But how do you answer that question? And if, you know, if you were a Zen monk who was given this koan, you'd have to find your way to an answer that your Roshi or Sensei would accept. And that might take you days or weeks or months. And we've been given an impossible question. How can we be the change we need to see in this world in a time when so much is seeming to destroy wholeness and health and hurt people and creatures and beautiful places? So, like, living in the pressure of that question, which we can't answer singly, you know, like, if I answer that question alone, what does that mean? We have to find our way into being human in a way that begins to be an answer to that question. Well, that koan, the guy who brought koan practice to Japan, Dogen, who traveled to China and learned Buddhism from the great masters there, he wrote this essay toward the end of his life called Genjo Koan. It's a very dense and paradoxical and hard to understand piece, but the interpreters of it that I've read say that one of its core ideas is that you're being given koans every day of your life by life itself. That
right.
That those, yeah. And that and you know, in a way, we've all been given a koan by the great teacher, life, which is, okay, let's give you access to all the wisdom traditions of the East and the West and the native peoples and the Abrahamic traditions, and they're all in conversation in your lifetime. You get all that. But let's have it be a time when your whole society has gone insane, in which everyone's disconnected from each other and the earth, and in which you're destroying yourself, and yet in which you have enough freedom that you can be an actor and an author. Like, how can you be with all that at once? And how can you be with others in a way that accepts responsibility for all that privilege and that adjacency to such monumental destruction? And how can you be deep enough to feel all that and yet lighthearted and free and humorous and loving and alive and playful enough to do it in a spirit that brings out what's best in you? Like, how can we live under the pressure of that impossible series of questions together? How could we be deep enough and real enough and never let ourselves off of any hooks? And how can you do that while you're, you know, for those of us who are Americans, and I'm sure some people will listen to this from other countries, but how can you be a privileged citizen of the wealthiest nation on earth while the leader of your country is embodying pretty much all the, you know, all 10 of the 7 deadly sins, I like to say.
Exactly.
Trump, you know, Trump, and he represents us. And for us to just take refuge in our comfort and privilege, it's sort of morally indefensible. And yet, for us to take that seriously and not be folded in upon ourselves and darkened in our ways of being, that's a challenge. So these are the conversations that feel most relevant right now for me.
Yeah, for me too. And I want to make sure that we have time. I wanted to ask you about this, Terry, is this rethinking and embracing a more feminine version of heroism. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes, which you spoke about, which I appreciated. Well, that's a big theme of my own story, because, you know, what I've realized is that in many ways I'm patterned by that old male story. I'm an older white male, becoming an increasingly illegitimate identity. I can't seem to get away from it, though. I'm half Jewish, but on my mom's side, I go back to the pilgrims. And, you know, my grandmother was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. I've got all that kind of Puritan blue blood kind of stuff going on. And I was schooled by my grandmother and my grandfather, and I was steeped in those kind of, you know, values of hard work and self-reliance and rationality and courage and commitment and so forth. And so I have a heroic impulse. I see what's happening in the world, and I want to come forward and do something that makes a difference. But the pattern that is readily at hand is this old pattern that is part of what created this problem. It was people like my people, my relatives, who enacted the genocide of the native people. It was people like my people who thought they would civilize the savages and bring them to Christianity and uplift them, and thought they knew better. It was people like my people who enacted a lot of violence. And so the old model of a separated mentality of I and you, you know, I and it, and I know better and I'll do the right thing, it's not adequate. We have to enter into a different relationship, In the book, I say it's not Achilles, but Saint Francis that is the model. It is, and right now we're in this amazing moment in culture in which women are much more than men. Men are behind women right now in contemporary culture because women really know, all women know, that their old role models and their old identities, you know, are just not adequate. They're in a creative relationship to remaking themselves and remaking their stories and remaking, you know, they're self-authoring.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas men need to do the same thing. Awake men are doing something similar because the old form of masculine identity wasn't helping us either. You know, we were suffering it as much as the women, but we haven't fully liberated ourselves from that old pattern, not as a cultural group. So it's women who are really taking leadership, but these qualities that are classic feminine qualities, that are heroic qualities, that are saintly qualities, that love, you know, that in a the woman who as a mother gives and gives and gives and doesn't expect to get back anything commensurate with what she gives, that quality of care and nurturance, of just having an open heart that feels and cares about the suffering and pain of others. Those are the qualities that we're going to have to find a way to live together. Now, I tell a story in the book of the Lindworm and the Lindworm's Bride. It's a Norwegian fairy tale that I heard told by the marvelous storyteller Martin Shaw. And it's quite a long story, and I couldn't even begin to do justice to it, so I won't try to retell it. But if you go into my book, you'll see a very simple telling of some of the lessons that I learned from it. But the point is, there is a kind of heroism that comes from preparing your heart, that comes from being willing to be with someone else and hold their feet to the fire as they go through a process of purification that may be painful. There's a heroism that comes from persisting in relationship even when it's unsatisfying and uncomfortable. There's a heroism that comes that expresses itself through courage and generosity, through a willingness to be in relationship and to experience discomfort and pain. And that kind of heroism is what can re-knit this, for one thing, the relations between men and women. I am discovering that in this time, men who are willing to be taught by a woman, who are willing to listen, who are willing to enter into authentic partnership with women, can play a creative role. That even though this is a yin moment, it's a moment in which the great pendulum needs the special genius of feminine, you know, greatness, feminine qualities, it doesn't mean that men don't still have a necessary role to play. In fact, for this feminine moment to be full, there need to be men. You know, I can try to be the kind of man who helps us to turn this turn of the screw in our evolutionary trajectory. So that where I'm going with that actually is, you know, there's another great saying by Thich Nhat Hanh that the next Buddha may very well be a Sangha. You've probably heard it.
Mm-hmm.
That the next great transcendental, you know, who's the next Buddha? It's the Buddha of the next awakening. Well, that Buddha would be a bunch of us together, a community of practice. Well, why would we be so great as to be a Buddha? We would be learning to love each other. We'd be learning to incarnate a kind of altruism and a kind of commitment to the future that would be so fierce that it would make a difference. I mean, we clearly need a kind of heroism in this time that's even greater than the kind of heroism that we see embodied in Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela. And yet, I don't believe that there's any single individual who could ever be serving that function. The transition from an extractive, exploitive, growth-addicted, consumption-addicted way of life to one that's permanently sustainable and lives in a sacred relationship to the whole web of life. How would that ever happen? Well, it might turn on a network of communities that begin to live a different principle. So becoming the kind of people who could be friends in a whole new way and create a different pattern out of which communities of practice could arise. You know, that seems like a plausible path forward. And to do that, we need each other. I need men and women friends, and so does everybody else.
Right. You know, I just had I just interviewed Patricia Albert, who wrote Evolutionary Relationships. Do you know of her work? So
I know her very well.
Oh, you know her
very participated well. In the Evolutionary Collective for a year. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. So to me, that's what you're talking about here. I love that. I have not participated. Mostly, it's just because of timing in my life and soon. But we had such a rich conversation, and I have her book, and I've read her book, and as I said to her, I'm there penciling in the beginning, and then I realized, forget it. I'm not going to pencil every single line in this book. I'm just going to dive in and at some point get to have that experience of relating in that way. I find like that's very, very cutting-edge, beautiful way of relating, and you obviously know that because you've experienced it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on with what's sometimes called we space, integral and evolutionary cultural experiments where people deepen into contact with, when our eyes meet, there's a third presence. There's you, there's me, and there's us, and the usness. Or the we space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, I feel like that kind of relating in whatever form it takes is really powerful. And I feel like that is really, as you were saying, the new collective heroism apart. You know, that coming together, which is a very feminine way of being. You know, the feminine way of being is being all inclusive, more all inclusive of everybody. You know, feeding all of us, man, woman, child, whatever that. So, Well, I'm aware of our time. We could talk to you for a really long time. This has been a really rich conversation, Terry. But I wanted to talk about. Share with the listeners the free gift download, which is an excerpt from your book, A New Republic of the Heart, An Ethos of Revolutionaries. And so you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. I hope that anyone who's resonated with some of what I've had to say will get a copy of my book and read it and tell your friends. And, you know, this I think I'm saying some new things that haven't been expressed quite this way. I think that the experience of reading the book can be quite a transformational experience for people. And there is a website that we've set up, newrepublicoftheheart.com, where people can sign up to get a free excerpt from the book, the introduction, and there's also a MP3 of me reading it, and I hope people will be moved to do that. Yeah.
Yes, so listeners, on the page that you, so newrepublicoftheheart.com, on the page that you've come into this interview from, you'll see all these links there. That link, you can go in, you can grab your audio download and the written download of the, I think it's the first three chapters in the introduction, and or you can do that and go buy the book. It just was published last week, and I feel like Terry really, really has a very new perspective on things, and you know, we've dipped into it a little bit here. So if you're moved, go certainly go get your free gifts and then go buy the book. I'm going to, for sure. So Terry, this has been such a rich conversation. Is there anything else that you feel moved to say that we haven't talked about before we close?
Well, I guess I just want to thank you for taking this time to introduce me to the community that is paying attention to your work, and to acknowledge that I need your help. Like, we're all facing questions right now, civilizational questions that none of us can answer except with each other's help. And to be in that, that's like an enormous evolutionary pressure. And yet, if we live in it authentically, I think it can be the source of maybe the most exciting and meaningful and productive times of our lives that really ennoble us, that maybe instead of this being a curse, it can be an amazing blessing and opportunity.
Yes. Well, that's a beautiful note to close on. So, Terry, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today on this interview and to inspire all the listeners. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure, too. I also want to thank all you listeners for joining us today on the Inner Warrior Summit, and please come back again tomorrow to hear another soul-inspiring interview. So have an empowered, light-filled rest of your day, and bye for now.